mean, ultimately, it's to bring awareness and make people, you know, realize what's really going on in this country. There are a lot of things that are going on that are unjust. People aren't being held accountable for. And that's something that needs to change. That's something that, you know, this country stands for freedom, liberty, justice for all. And it's not happening for all right now.
That's Colin Kaepernick in 2016. He's speaking to reporters in a locker room interview following the first game after he chose to sit rather than stand while the national anthem played. Much has changed in the 5 years since this moment. Colin Kaepernick is no longer playing in the NFL, shut out by what appears to be collusion among the professional teams. But Colin Kaepernick's choice to take a knee made him much more than a quarterback. It transformed him into a catalyst for meaningful social discourse and change. During the past 5 years, thousands of athletes have elevated their fields of play into platforms for change. These athlete activists kneel in the same tradition that 1968 Olympic medalist Tommy Smith and John Carlos stood.
The United States leads the Olympics in medal awards and is just about supreme in the sprint races, thanks to men like Tommy Smith and John Carlos. Yesterday, they came in first and third in the 200-meter dash, and then stood on the victory platform with bowed heads, wearing black socks and gloves in a racial protest.
Colin Kaepernick's silent protest was soon repeated by athletes from all sports, from many racial backgrounds, and from grade school to the professional leagues.
U.S. soccer star Megan Rapinoe decided to take a knee during the national anthem last night in a friendly match against Thailand.
Players from Madison East High School and Madison West High School took a knee during the pregame national anthem on Friday night. School administrators say that they support the students.
Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation, talked with dozens of these brave athletes for his new book, The Kaepernick Effect: Taking a Knee, Changing the World. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and we begin today's episode of The Takeaway with an in-depth conversation about this new book with its author, Dave Zirin.
For the young people with whom I spoke, taking the knee is about a language. It's about a method. It's about a way to show their community that they are upset about racial inequity and police brutality. That's what it is in its most broad form. Now, they could be doing it because of a local incident. They could be doing it because the memory of people like Philando Castile and Alton Sterling and Sandra Bland just falls heavily upon their shoulders and they want to express that. But for whatever the individual motivation, most broadly, it's because when Colin Kaepernick took that knee, it showed these young athletes that there was something that they could do. And so they just, you know, pardon the mixed sports metaphor, but they just took the baton and ran with it.
So tell us one story, one athlete, one town that has stuck with you most after having completed the book.
Well, I'll tell you something, Melissa. It's almost tough to try to think of one, only because these young people were so open with me. And it's like choosing one almost feels like playing favorites because I've got such incredible reservoirs of affection for all the people with whom I spoke. We've stayed in contact. I went back and re-interviewed just about everybody after the police murder of George Floyd and the demonstrations broke out in the summer of 2020 to see how they were feeling about that. So, you know, there are layers here of connection that I want to honor. But at the same time, when you ask the question, it's difficult for me not to think about somebody like Rodney Axon Jr., who's the very first story in the book. By my calculations and research, Rodney Axon was the first person in this country after Colin Kaepernick to put their knee on the ground. So of all the women, men, young boys, young girls, different sports, it actually started with a football player in Brunswick, Ohio. And that's Rodney Axon. That's a suburb of Cleveland. And Rodney Axon felt like he had no choice but to take that knee because he had been just filled with just a lot of anger and dissatisfaction because there was a ton of racism on the football team. Here he was. His family had moved him out of Cleveland to a predominantly white suburb and school in Brunswick because they thought the family would be safer there and get a better education. And far from feeling safe, he is confronted with racism, with police harassment. and just feeling like a fish out of water. And so for him, it was like, what am I doing here? Why is this happening to me? Why is this my existence? And he was searching for some way just to show everybody that racism was not okay in Brunswick, and he was tired of having to bear the brunt of it. And he reminded me so much of something that a young woman told me later in the book. And then she said that, you know, people say I made them uncomfortable, but I figured if I'm making you uncomfortable for 2 minutes by taking that knee, you know how I feel every day. And sit with that. So Rodney, just when he sees Colin Kaepernick take that knee, it's like a big light bulb going off over his head. It's a eureka moment. It's a yes, that's what you're doing. Here's something that I can do. So Rodney Axon then takes the knee. And of course, that's really where the story just begins. And in so much of the book, you know, the knee is really not the culmination, but it's almost the launching point. Because then you have to deal with the backlash, you have to deal with the results. And Rodney Axon had to deal with, in a lot of respects, the worst of all the stories, in that his coach didn't support him, his teammates didn't support him. He started getting violent death threats coming over the wires of social media directed at himself and his family, racial slurs to a profound degree. And it was so terrible that he felt like he had to walk his little sister to school every day, you know, an elementary school age child, because he was worried for her safety. And yet, despite all of that, Rodney Axon felt no sense of regret whatsoever. In fact, he felt just a tremendous amount of pride that he was willing to stand up and force people in Brunswick, Ohio, to think about their behavior and also very systemically how a Rodney Axon even fits into a community like Brunswick, Ohio. So I think of Rodney a lot because to me it's evocative of the courage that so many people in the book show, and so evocative also of the lack of regret or remorse about what they did.
You touch on another key aspect as you were telling us his story. In the book, you write both about athletes who took this knee, took this stand, made this statement as solo actors, often because they had to be, right? But then there are also times when it's the whole team, when the team makes a decision together to stand, to kneel, to be in solidarity. Tell us a little bit about, one, how that happens, how it is that some teams made that whole decision, and then also what difference it makes when the whole team is part of it.
You know, Melissa, I have a good friend named Joe Ehrman, and he played for the old Baltimore Colts, and he does coaching seminars. And Joe has this thing that he says, where he says, there are two kinds of coaches, the transactional and the transformational. And the transactional coach is the person who is in it for themselves and for how coaching young people makes them feel and how winning makes them feel and their own status in a community because of the actions of children. And that, unfortunately, is that unflattering description describes, I would argue, most youth coaches in this country. The transformational coach is the person who's in it for the kids, who's in it for their, who sees themselves as an educator and is in this to educate the kids themselves. In situations where you have transformational as opposed to transactional coaches, only there do you see the whole team really come together and turn it into, from an act of a single person who can be isolated, who can be scapegoated, who can be attacked, and you turn it into almost like an I am Spartacus moment, where everybody is saying, you know what, if you come after one of us, you're coming after all of us. And they take the rhetoric, the sometimes very thin rhetoric about a sports team being like a family, and they take that very seriously. So if one person in the family is upset, everybody should be upset. If one person has an issue, then everybody has an issue. And what the coach does is it doesn't, the coach does, he or she or they do not just snap their fingers and say, let's have a team meeting and talk about racism, but they actually artfully and skillfully facilitate a conversation that allows for true empathy and true solidarity.
How did the team protest of the Missouri football team happen?
That's just a remarkable story. The Missouri football team made history in a way that I think sent shockwaves of fear down the spines of every college president in the United States. And to me, it's like I still go back to it sometimes and shudder with joy.
That's how I felt. I was like, yes, I've been waiting for this moment in college sports.
I know. And that was, let's remember, that was in 2015, November. Colin Kaepernick is August of 2016. So the power of the athlete was already, we forget this sometimes, was strongly in the air by the time Colin Kaepernick decided to take his knee. What made Colin Kaepernick different and what made him, I think, historically very significant was using that anthem space by which to express his dissent, which then spread like wildfire, which I express in the book, and the power of the symbolism of taking that knee. That's a specific language Colin Kaepernick gave, but it's not the ultimate expression of power that we've seen. And the ultimate expression of power is first seen in that Missouri football team in, I believe it was November of 2015. And in brief order, this story, the University of Missouri, I mean, Missouri has such a legacy of racism, both as a state, but also on that campus that goes back decades. This has been a Missouri issue for decades of students, particularly black and brown students, of saying we have a problem here and it needs to be addressed, and having their concerns fall upon uncaring ears. And after a series of incidents, of violent incidents on campus, incidents that involved also racist graffiti on campus, some students decided that enough was enough. And so they started to engage in regular civil disobedience, hunger strikes, very influenced by the Black Lives Matter movement. Missouri is a very short distance, although another world, from Ferguson, Missouri. And several students started doing the drive to Ferguson to be part of the protests and breaking that kind of invisible wall between this institution of higher learning and this impoverished community dealing with regular police repression. So they make the decision that they're going to engage in much more aggressive direct action against racism on campus. And the school president and the school provost, they're largely just sort of poo-pooing it and saying, pish posh, not a big deal. And then one student started to engage in a hunger strike right in the middle of campus. And it started to get a great deal of attention. And then a lot of students, particularly black women, it was black women, just putting it out there, went to the football team and said, he's killing himself to fight racism on this campus, and you're not doing anything. Like, you know, the football team at the University of Missouri at the time, 69% black, and the campus as a whole, 7%. And so saying, like, here's one institution where we actually have numbers and power. And it's like, what are you going to do about it? What are you willing to risk? And the football team, starting with the black athletes on the team, but it became the entire team, including an almost all-white coaching staff, all decided that they were not going to play until the issues of racism were addressed on campus. And immediately, the situation goes from a school president and a school provost sort of like smiling and being like, oh, isn't that cute? Students are protesting, to the school losing $1 million a week because there's no college football. And then the provost and the president find themselves out of work within days.
So as you're telling that story, it's so critical that you point to black women organizers, student organizers on campus who in part go to the football team. But it's also a reminder that that this position of taking the knee or of protesting can be harder to garner the same kind of sort of power effect for women athletes. So over and over again, right, we see women actually in the vanguard, or particularly women athletes in the vanguard of supporting everything from the movement for Black Lives to voter registration, but they get far fewer cameras and much less press. Why do you think it's less important to us? Is it really just about the media attention when women athletes are the ones who take the stand or take the knee?
Yeah, I mean, most basically, I mean, the blunt response I'll give is, you know, sexism is a hell of a drug. And there's a lot of it in this country. And there's an extra layer of it when we're talking about black and brown women. And their heroism gets routinely written out of history, routinely and repeatedly. And this is not a modern thing, and this is not a sports thing. And sometimes I'll tell you something, Melissa, my hackles as a sports, I'll say an amateur sports historian, my hackles go up a big time when people talk about women being denied sports at the turn of the 20th century, because it was actually white women that didn't have sports. Black women organized their own leagues immediately. And there are huge articles in like the Chicago Defender and the Amsterdam News about black women's sports leagues that would be very highly attended. You know, the Chicago Defender once did a poll of favorite athletes in the community, and over half of them were women. This was like at the turn of the 20th century. And you know, so we forget that at our peril. And we have this incredible historical blindness because of the twin evils of racism and sexism about the roles that black women have played. And that's why, I mean, honestly, like I'm not asking for a cookie, I swear. But when I did the book, it was very important to me to make sure that that representation was real, because the knee story is not a male story. You know, it's a story of people across sports and across genders wanting to be heard, because the revulsion towards police brutality, the revulsion towards racial inequity, that has touched people across the board. And that was represented in the streets in the summer of 2020, and it was represented in the athletic fields in the lead up to 2020.
As you talk about being something that mattered across genders, we are watching state legislators across the country introducing legislation to ban trans athletes from grade school sports, from high school sports. Just in terms of thinking about the ways that you have some athletes who are able to choose what it means to be political, so they're or to protest, so they're playing their sport, and then they take that knee, they put their body in a position that makes a statement. But there are these other athletes, and their bodies make a statement just by being their bodies.
This is going to be one of the great struggles going forward, because the anti trans hysteria has become a staple of the right wing in this country, and they've tried different avenues by which to demonize people for no reason other than them being their true selves. I mean, we remember first they tried bathrooms, and it didn't really take like they dreamed, this mass demonization of the idea of the bathroom bill. And if anything, there was a terrific pushback against it, especially when it was pointed out that cisgender people are the people who have been committing sexual assaults in bathrooms. So it became some sort of thing like, oh, look, maybe we shouldn't talk about that because the mirror is on us now. But with sports, they feel like they have found purchase in a way to try to divide people and split people and put forward just yet another boogeyman of this idea of your child is being denied because someone else is trying to succeed. And isn't that the root of so much prejudice in our society? That idea of people trying to self-victimize for the purpose of oppressing somebody else. I mean, so much of modern racism is defined by that lens of self-victimization, and then therefore justifying political or sometimes literal violence through an act of, and I want to, the word self is so important here, self-victimization, not real victimization, not the actuality of being victimized, but the idea of projecting that lens upon yourself so you can act outside the norms of society because you do it under the guise of saying, well, I'm defending my family, I'm doing that. We see that across so many political issues. And it's something we need to stand up against, particularly in the sports world, because the heart of the sports world should be about inclusion. And I recognize that the very nature of the history of sports in this country has been about the fight for inclusion, whether we're talking about Jackie Robinson, whether we're talking about Billie Jean King. The fight for inclusion has been the story of sports. And what we're learning is that it continues into the 21st century.
My last question for you. So when you were talking about that distinction between transactional and transformational, I was thinking that it's also true sometimes of relationships that journalists have with their sources. Sometimes they are truly just transactional, but I have known you long enough and seen you in relationship with many of the athletes that you have developed relationship with to know that you do not have a transactional relationship with the folks who you speak with and who help you and help all of us to understand the sports world. So it is with the sense of undoubtedly the depth with which you can answer this question that I ask, how is Colin Kaepernick doing right now?
Well, Colin Kaepernick is somebody who's undergoing his own transformational project. We haven't really heard from him much at all over the last 5 years, but we're going to be hearing a lot from him in the next year. And he's going to be telling his story by his terms with the help of people like Ava DuVernay and with the help of his own book publisher, which he started to speak about the issues that are dear to him, namely issues around police and prison reform, if not outright abolition. So we're going to hear a great deal from Colin Kaepernick in the next year, because I would argue that his transformation is really just beginning.
Dave Zirin, as always, thank you for bringing us voices and analysis and a certain kind of heart to thinking about sports and the world of sports. Dave Zirin is sports editor for The Nation and author of The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee, Changing the World. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
Now, we asked you, our listeners, to tell us about a defining moment in sports activism that has had an impact on you.
This is Andrea Wilcox from Scottsdale, Arizona. Colin Kaepernick was willing to forfeit his career. Whether you agree with why he did it or not, his sacrifice is impossible to ignore. Thus, the issues he was trying to elevate are impossible to ignore.
Hi, this is Katie from Santa Fe, New Mexico, and my activists, sport activist heroes are Colin Kaepernick, as always, who took a stand for everyone who believes in freedom and equality, and of course, Simone Biles, who took a stand for her well-being and shining a light on the emotional and psychic toll that high performance and just daily trying to act normal during a global pandemic can take.
The life of Muhammad Ali has guided me throughout my life. He was the voice of the voiceless. I am Kwame Abdul-Bey from Little Rock, Arkansas.
Yes, this is Mike Scott from Spokane, Washington. And for me, it was the Black Power Fists in the Air protest at the 68 Olympics. It took a great deal of courage to send such a message to the whole world, knowing the hatred they would face upon their return to the U.S.
I got my potato
on Radiolab,
and I'm looking at it and I'm holding it.
We consider the mundane.
It's a handsome shape.
And stop to smell the potatoes.
I've been telling people about my potato. They're always surprised, and I say, you wouldn't understand.
Small potatoes on Radiolab.
It's my friend.
Listen wherever you get podcasts.
In Texas, lawmakers are currently considering a bill that would ban transgender students from playing on sports teams that align with their gender identity. After passing in the state Senate in three separate sessions this year, SB3 just needs to pass in the Texas House. And Texas is just one of many states that have placed restrictions on transgender student athletes in recent years. In total, at least 30 states have introduced similar legislation, and it's become law in 8. For more on this, we're joined now by Katie Barnes, features writer at ESPN. Katie, it's so great to have you here.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to talk about this.
So why did state legislatures decide this year that trans kids were a big threat who needed to be legislated against?
Yeah, this is something that's been building over the course of a handful of years. The first law passed in Idaho in 2020. And after that, there was a wave of legislation that mirrored that law. But previous to even Idaho passing its law, there had been examples of states looking to pass into law legislation that was similar, whether it was regulating high school athletics and collegiate athletics through birth certificate, or looking to overturn an existing policy at that state's high school association. It's been a building conversation, and this year is the year that it really broke through because so many states considered such legislation and then many passed it.
Now, I'm wondering if these sets of laws are much like the bathroom bills that we saw sort of in an earlier wave, which talk about birth certificates and gender identity and sex assigned at birth, but also are using kind of a narrative of protecting girls and women. The bathroom bills kept coming back to this language about sort of safety in the bathroom for girls and women. And so what I'm wondering is if there is a similar discourse here about sports, that even though it's about trans athletes, that there's a particular focus on girls' sports.
There is. A number of the bills are actually titled the Save Women's Sports Act or Protect Women's Sports or Fairness in Girls' Sports, something like that. Thematically, there is a lot of discussion around the sanctity of girls and women's sports and the need to protect the integrity of that category. And so transgender girls and transgender women have become the intense focus of many of these pieces of legislation. However, it is important to note that there are examples of states either considering legislation that would affect transgender boys, or in the case of Alabama, does affect transgender boys explicitly in the text.
Can you say a little bit more about the Alabama text?
Yeah, so in Alabama, the law does not just restrict participation around transgender girls and women participating in girls and women's sports. It also protects the boys and men's category as well. And so folks who are assigned female at birth are not eligible to play boys' sports in Alabama, according to that law, unless there is no equivalent girls' sporting category. So, you know, there is no girls wrestling in Alabama. There's no girls football in Alabama, but there is girls soccer. There is girls track and field. And so it gets really muddy and complicated very fast. But that is in the text itself. It goes both ways.
So, Katie, let's talk a bit about these scientific myths about gender and sexuality that you are beginning to frame here. And thinking about this challenge that we have had these sort of separate sports spheres, this kind of dichotomy, at a time that we're coming to understand that these dichotomies may not even be an accurate way to understand and categorize human beings.
Yeah, so I think a lot of the stuff about the science is just that it doesn't really say what anyone wants it to say, if that makes sense. There's so little data around not just transgender athletes, but transgender athletes at specific ages who are experiencing different forms of puberty, who may or may not be on hormone replacement therapy, and the effect of, for example, taking hormone replacement therapy and puberty blockers on athletic performance for those who are assigned male at birth who never go through endogenous male puberty. So there's so little information about the specifics of the conversation being had. And instead, there's a lot of assumption that's rooted in our cultural norms around what we assume to be true when it comes to gender and to how that plays out in sports. And so it gets very complicated very fast, simply because everyone is operating from their own frameworks, their own experiences, and applying that in a really broad-based macro way.
Help us to understand how Title IX is at this intersection. Shouldn't Title IX be offering some protections?
You know, there's a question about who Title IX applies to. And that is something that has been fought at the federal level across three administrations at this point, and is really the underlying discussion that spurred a lot of the public debate on this issue. And so the Obama administration passed a Dear Colleague letter in 2016 that would have included transgender kids to be protected in schools, including locker rooms and athletics. In response to the issuing of that guidance, 23 states eventually sued the Obama administration, and it was blocked in federal court and never went into effect. And then when the Trump administration took office, one of the first things they did was rescind that guidance. And now there's discussion about what's the new guidance going to be from the Biden administration. And the current Secretary of Education has been unequivocal in his support for transgender youth, but there is no federal policy. And so right now what is occurring is a debate over the interpretation of Title IX law and whom Title IX protects, and not a discussion about you know, what is the federal law that deals with transgender athletes specifically. And so as these cases are continuing to be litigated as they affect transgender youth, so looking at the Gavin Grimm case, which was recently settled, and then also even the effects of Bostock from last year that affected employment law and Title VII as it applies to transgender people and also the LGBTQ community more broadly and those protections, that is a real site of contention between everybody because there isn't an explicit nod in a law that was written in 1972 before we were really having these discussions about gender so publicly and so broadly.
What are some of the other legal options for these young athletes and their families, and maybe even just sort of the strategies? What are they trying right now to protect themselves against these laws?
Families right now are lobbying in almost every state. Anytime there is a state that's considering these bills, these families go to the state house and they tell their stories to their legislatures. That is happening over and over and over again. In a state like Texas, which has had hearing after hearing on its piece of legislation, these families go and have these conversations publicly and privately, if some of them are not out publicly, with their legislators begging them to not pass these laws. But then once they are passed, you know, there have been a number of lawsuits that have been filed. So in Idaho, that law never went into effect. It was blocked the August of that same year. It passed in federal court because of a lawsuit. In West Virginia, there was a preliminary injunction granted to a specific student so that she could try out for her cross-country team. But the law is continuing to be litigated. There's been lawsuits filed in Florida with promises of litigation in all of the rest of the states that have actually passed a bill like this into law. And so that seems to be where the focus is right now, is once the bill becomes law, suing and trying to get an injunction or get the law thrown out. But those things take time. And the longer they take, the more kids who aren't being able to play sports.
Yeah. In the meantime, kids are matriculating through school. Yeah, absolutely. Katie Barnes is a features writer at ESPN. Katie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Sexism is a hell of a drug. And there's a lot of it in this country. And there's an extra layer of it when we're talking about black and brown women. And their heroism gets routinely written out of history. Routinely and repeatedly. And this is not a modern thing, and this is not a sports thing.
That's Nation sports editor Dave Zirin, who we spoke with earlier in the hour, talking about women athletes and women's teams who are often on the front lines of social and political action, but find themselves there unseen. In the summer of 2020, the Atlanta Dream women's basketball team's public support of Black Lives Matter drew criticism from their then owner, the former U.S. Senator who denounced the Black Lives Matter movement. The team responded by donning simple black t-shirts that read, "Vote Warnock." Now at the time, the Reverend Dr. Raphael Warnock was running a tight race for Georgia's U.S. Senate seat against the incumbent, who was also one of the team owners. After a runoff in early 2021, Warnock won and became the first black U.S. senator from Georgia. And to be clear, these women did much more than just wear a t-shirt. They approached their protest with a clear political strategy. Listen to this CNN interview with Atlanta Dream player Elizabeth Williams.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm not sure you've referred to her by name yet during this interview. I think you keep referring to her as the co-owner of the team. Is there a reason for that?
Yes, there is. As we kind of shifted into this more political sphere of how things were moving, we talked to people in politics and they talked about the power of saying someone's name. And so you can also do the opposite by not saying someone's name.
Yo, they straight ghosted their team owner. And trust me, y'all, this takes some serious courage. Of course, the effectiveness of these actions relies on media coverage. And while D1 football or professional men's basketball routinely garner significant local and national press coverage, many other sports and leagues and women's teams play and protest without headlines. In other words, if a girls' field hockey team protests in the forest of media disinterest, do they make a sound? Joining me now, Amira Rose Davis, Assistant Professor of History and African American Studies at Penn State and co-host of the feminist sports podcast, Burn It All Down. Amira, welcome back.
Yeah, always a pleasure to be here.
And Bradford William Davis is an investigative reporter based in New York, exploring race, class, and health, especially within Major League Baseball and the wider sports industry. Welcome back to you too, Bradford.
Thanks for having me.
So, Amira, how do athletes use the press to make a point if they don't get any press?
Yeah, well, one of the advantages over the last decade or so has been social media, which has really been a disruption to this long history of Black women's protests being overlooked, of marginalized sporting lives being kind of not considered. And so they move in silence a lot, but they also reach out and use a variety of tools at their disposal, whether it's social media, whether it's Zoom, Elizabeth Williams and the Dream and the whole WNBA, for instance, lived on Zoom calls with Kimberly Crenshaw, with activists on the ground, and didn't necessarily work in the spotlight to do the work that they were doing, but built really, really strong connections that a lot of people missed. A lot of people just didn't see until it popped up because they changed the course of history and the way they impacted the Georgia elections. And so we see new tools building, but they still are interacting with the media in various ways. And a lot of times it's simply reminding them that they're there, again, saying, hello, this is what you're missing. You're missing this. You're telling it in a very simple narrative. And we're going to continue to tell our story and to live our lives and insist, right, that you cover us, but we're not going to go begging for it.
So it's interesting, this point about sort of the use of new tools, but also, Amir, I'm just so impressed by the ways that as emerging activists, right, they were in contact with folks around philosophy and theories of activism. And Bradford, I guess, you know, I've been back and forth on trying to think about whether sort of the pay inequities, the realities that folks like, you know, players on the Atlanta Dream get paid so much less than big league players, if that might actually constitute a space of relative freedom or capacity. In other words, if you don't make 10 million or 20 or 30 million, is it easier to risk it or not?
No, that's a great question, Melissa. I have to wonder that the economic proximity to the realities of racial injustice, not to say that racism doesn't affect anyone regardless of the class status, but it certainly is more of a threat when you are on the economic margins as well. I wonder if that closeness, you know, from a league that is newer and also has to deal with institutional sexism and racism leading to just less fruits of you know, a capitalistic sort of sports industry, kind of just makes it a little bit more tangible about the need for change and the desire to fight for it.
I like that language of economic proximity to the realities that come from that racial inequities. Bradford, I'm also wondering then, part of it is, you know, so women's teams, women's basketball teams, like we saw with the Atlanta Dream, we saw this with New York Liberty when they were out in front around Black Lives Matter kind of wave one. But I'm wondering, are there other kinds of sports where you may have queer folk, men, women playing, but simply because of the kind of sport it is, it receives less media attention?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, the women's game has been shaded and dissed since the moment it's been inaugurated, you know, in the 90s. I mean, I was just a kid, you know, when the W started, but like, you know, I grew up sadly making, but also hearing plenty of jokes about like, oh, they can't dunk. Oh, they can't do this or that. You know, it's always been a fight where they've had to kind of just be respected and dignified on the terms of its own sport as something that is equivalent and clearly in some ways greater than the way the men's leagues, you know, choose to move. So that's a real issue, a real problem. It's exacerbated by not having enough women in sports media, especially women of color. There was a recent study done that showed the incredibly low percentages of women of color, you know, including, you know, but not limited to Black women who are actually in like credentialed sports media positions. There's lots of fantastic people on, you know, on blogs and Twitter, but people who actually get to go to games and interview them and then write them up for a paper, the magazine or whatever, it's few and far between. That's a huge issue. And of course, people who again are, you know, using that word again, proximity, you know, more proximate to the lives and interests and, you know, and, you know, I guess, in sporting culture of, you know, women's leagues are going to not only want to cover the league, but also be able to cover it better in some ways. And they're just not being hired or promoted in the ways that they ought to be. So I really do believe that's a problem and a barrier that leads to less coverage and the sort of persistent discrimination that the league has to continue fighting.
Amir, I want to go back to Dave Zirin's point at the very beginning of our conversation and even to what Bradford was just saying. And I'll just put it this way. Is sexism a hell of a drug for sports media?
Yeah, sexism, racism, the intersection especially is a hell of a drug. I really like that phrase that you use, economic proximity, Bradford, because to your earlier question, is it easier, is there freedom? Well, if you have less, you also, it's very easy to have that taken away too. When you mentioned at the top of the show, when they were wearing protest shirts in the summer of 2016, the league tried to fine them, right, for those shirts. And I think one of the reasons why the WNBA is such a useful kind of conduit to have these conversations about Black women is because they're really the canary in the mine. So they exemplify, right, how it's very easy to slip through the cracks and be overlooked. So sports that don't get enough traction, women's sports by and large, but also you see here through them what happens when Black women specifically, right, try to claim these sporting spaces. I'm so glad you mentioned that report, Bradford, because I think it also exemplifies this when we think about sports media. In that report, you talk about gender gains, you talk about people of color gains, and it looks like it's going up, up, up until you zoom in and realize Black women specifically will be like, for example, 1.1% of sports reporters. And so I think all of these things tying together helps us see, right, how easy it is for it to persist because these stories aren't being told. And when they are, they're framed very narrowly by people who don't resemble at all who's on the court, who's on the pitch, who's on the field.
So Amira, as you, so what I've seen you both do here is to reflect and pull out that notion of economic proximity of the players to those who are most affected by the inequities that they're protesting. But I also hear you, Amira, making a claim about the value of proximity of the reporters themselves to the athletes and their lived experience on whom they are reporting. And yet there's also this sort of, you know, old-fashioned or maybe new-fashioned journalistic norm suggesting that proximity to our subjects is actually a problem for our journalistic capacity. How do you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we do this in history as well. This idea of objectivity itself is just like, you know, it's a little bit stale at this point. And I think that we have been able to see that, especially in sports media, the consequence of not having a diverse array of voices, right? We see this when you get Brock Turner's swimming times in many articles about him committing sexual assault. We see this when ESPN columnists take up space to defend the Washington football team's name. And then when his father-in-law corrects him and says, no, actually, this is offensive, he still has column space to continue to write these articles because there's not Native voices in those newsrooms. I think that we continue to see the consequence, and yet clinging to this idea of distance, of objectivity, I think really just gets in the way of better reporting, better understanding. Like, I think that we should just not be basic. And what we know is we get amazing stories with new voices. I mean, Shakia Taylor, shout out to her, 538 ran a piece, dope piece, where she did data analysis, right, on do-rags in baseball, right? Mm-hmm. And the correlation to pitching. And I mean, like, that is a story that would have been very hard to see even 5 years ago.
All right. I love that sort of specificity around that. And I remember that piece and was like, okay, this is why changing what's happening in newsrooms matters. Bradford, I want to talk on exactly this topic about Dom Smith of the New York Mets. He took a knee during the national anthem after Jacob Blake was shot and killed by police. And then he fielded questions during an understandably difficult press conference. I want to just take a listen for a moment.
I've been very emotional. Kind of see this, you know, continuously happen. So, it was a long day for me. So, kind of wasn't there mentally, but we'll be all right.
Bradford, what difference does it make who writes the story about that moment?
You know, man, first of all, this connects all the dots because shout out to Shakia Taylor once again. The do-rag piece was about Marcus Stroman, Dom Smith's teammate on the Mets, who, you know, wears different color do-rags and apparently performs differently depending on the color he's wearing, which is incredible. Again, shout out to Shake. She's awesome. But yeah, Dom is, you know, you hear and see his hurt on that call. And I think the difference between, I guess, cultural competency, which is often aided by, you know, lived experience, which means, again, hire more Black reporters, is, you know, that having that difference could be a difference between, I guess, I think, emotional pornography, mm-hmm. for lack of a better word, mm-hmm. to a thoughtful, nuanced interrogation of all the issues that led to that moment. And so what I saw a lot in the local press was just that, you know, him sobbing, just being played over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. And it's like, it's clearly not for me because I know I'm sad. Mm-hmm. I know I'm angry. It's, you know, it's for the presumed, you know, and probably unfortunately likely Major League Baseball, you know, majority of people of media consumers, you know, which are like white folks of a certain class, you know, like, and, you know, they're the ones who need to be in probably in a lot of minds convinced that racism actually is bad and makes you feel bad. Like, mm-hmm. and that is, you know, I get that, but it's still kind of gross to me because that shouldn't need to be argued, certainly not in 2021. And a more thoughtful, layered exploration of all that was going down, all the team dynamics, the fact that he was kneeling alone on the field without any of his teammates of any color, you know, joining him, all that kind of stuff, you know, ought to be interrogated and assessed, and it really don't get that far most of the time because of the makeup of the press corps on print or on film. So
Amira Rose Davis is Assistant Professor of History and African American Studies at Penn State and also co-host of the feminist sports podcast, Burn It All Down. And Bradford William Davis is an investigative reporter based in New York, exploring race, class, and health, especially within Major League Baseball and the wider sports industry. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
This is dope. Thank you.
That's our show for today, folks, and we're going to leave you with a few words from Nation sports editor Dave Zirin.
Part of that transactional, transformational, it does inform me as a journalist, so any money I'm making from this book, I'm giving to an organization called Serve Your City DC that works with mutual aid and trying to raise up young people in the DC area, because I couldn't stand the idea that I'm going to profit from the courage of these young people, so instead I'm going to pay it forward. And every person I interviewed knows that that's what the book is going towards, and now it gives them a sense of mission about it as well. The importance of it being a transformational project is so important to me.
Now, here at The Takeaway, we are inspired by this idea of journalism that is transformational rather than transactional. So keep listening. In the coming weeks, we're going to often wrap up our show with transformational takeaways. These will be short stories of people who are making room for others, who are making a difference in their communities, and making all of us pay attention to issues that matter. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Come on back and hang out with us again tomorrow.